We learned long ago how to take advantage of what the Earth offers, but we continue to struggle as a species with how best to return the favor and replenish the planet as we reap its bounty. That's what permaculture is all about, letting us take the benefits from nature and pay them back in the process. Our first guest this hour lays out the general concepts in a handsomely illustrated book called The Permaculture Promise. John O'Niger is a conservation biologist and a permaculture designer and educator. If he's not teaching individuals and organizations permaculture, he's making systems that implement the principles of permaculture. John O. lives in Massachusetts. Thanks for joining us on The Exchange today.
Hi, Jeffrey. Thanks for having me on the program.
Good to have you. So does permaculture move a step or two beyond simple sustainability?
Yes, that's right. I think it's in addition to really trying to create more sustainable systems, we're also looking to create regenerative systems, and that's, as you mentioned, where we're wanting to give back to the ecosystem that we've taken so much from and create within our homes and our communities where we're growing food and getting our water and all of our needs met, but we're also beginning to restore and regenerate the ecosystem.
So it really does go way beyond just growing things on the land, then. I mean, it's more than just the agriculture part of it.
That's right. It's all the pieces fitting together. It's a whole systems design perspective and strategies. So, you know, these are big, complex problems that we're facing about energy sources and climate changes and drought and flood. And so really we have to have this larger whole systems thinking perspective to be able to address those problems. And so, you know, whether it can be as simple as doing a few things in our home, but also how are we changing in our communities and the businesses that we operate and the schools that we have.
As you lay out the concepts in the book, John, it's clear that little tweaks can make some rather large differences in the things we're doing for the planet.
That's right, yes. And so, you know, even just the way that we grow food, where we're growing food, that's a really exciting change sweeping across the country, really, is bringing food growing into in our homes and or our properties and communities, doing community gardens, school gardens. And so those simple changes of just learning how to grow food and beginning to understand that, you know, that saves a lot of energy. It just reduces the amount of food that's being shipped around the planet from faraway places. And then it's got all these multiple benefits. It's also giving us healthier food, and it's also connecting us to where our food comes from and learning about soil and about plants and ecology.
And when I talk about little tweaks, it's things like, as you point out, not just buying food locally, but if you're growing your own, where to place your garden in relation to the house. How critical can that be, for example?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Right. Simple kind of planning and design thinking changes by having those areas around your home that need the most care. Keep them really close to your back door where you're going to walk out of your house and get to it. And it's just that simple little change of thinking of where do I put things to make it easier to care for, so it can have the attention that it needs, makes a huge difference. And so we have kind of a zone thinking, whereas those inner zones are the most intensive, most cared for, whether it's your garden or maybe it's animals, small livestock like chickens or ducks that are right close in, certain plants that you might have that you really want to harvest a lot from. Maybe they're tea herbs or a special plant that you're growing. And then as you go further out in the landscape, there's all these things that just don't need as much care, and they can be further away. And that really creates this very synergistic and ease of moving through the landscape, and really it makes everything work together that much better, in addition to saving energy.
Moving through the landscape probably sounds a little hollow to some people, and I'm sure you probably have a few who come up to you and say, well, you know, I live in the burbs and I have a small lot. What could I possibly do? And what's your answer?
Right. Well, it's really amazing. What we've seen is people living in all different situations, even urban properties with only a balcony, suburban lots with a very small yard, can do a whole bunch of things. And we talk about creating small-scale intensive systems, and you can do quite a bit of gardening and growing. You can put some dwarf fruit trees in. You can have small livestock, like I mentioned, chickens, ducks, geese, kind of, you know, really kind of just is only limited by people's imagination. As we've seen where in very small areas, a whole lot of things can be done, which makes it really exciting. It also keeps it from being overwhelming. If you have a small space and you're just going to do a few things, that's great. You know, maybe you're going to collect some water and barrel. You're going to put a terrace in if you have a steep slope, and you're going to create a nice walking path or a sitting space outside that has some flowers for pollinators or some culinary herbs. Those things are all great for the environment, and they also create beautiful spaces on the land. So there's lots of different benefits, and then, you know, it can expand out from there. So we often talk to people about just starting from where you're at, starting out your back door.
I'm really intrigued by the concept of dwarf fruit trees. I mean, we just got a couple seconds left of the break, but how big are these?
Mm-hmm. Oh, those can be anywhere from 3 to 5 or 6 feet tall, and they can fit in really small spaces.
Wow, intriguing stuff. Much more to talk about with John O'Niger. His book is The Permaculture Promise, what permaculture is and how it can help us. We'll come back and talk more about permaculture installations and a little more about the overall concept of permaculture itself. When we come back to the Jefferson Exchange, we'll take your phone calls and emails as well when we return in a minute 15. On the Jefferson Exchange, on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is John O'Niger, a conservation biologist and permaculture designer and educator. He's written a book, lavishly illustrated, called The Permaculture Promise, what permaculture is and how it can help us. And there's a bunch of stuff in here about exactly what permaculture is on a broad conceptual scale and how you can execute it on a real, local, right-in-your-own-backyard scale. Join us at 800-838-3760 by phone. By email, jx@jeffnet.org. So this is not a real new thing. I mean, the idea of taking care of the planet actually is an ancient sort of way of thinking about things. How hard can it be, though, Jono, to get people to think in terms of how things were done a long time ago versus the, well, this is the way we've always done it, meaning the last few decades kind of thinking?
That's right. That's right. That's a great question. And it takes a lot, actually. It takes a lot of sort of retraining ourselves to undo some bad habits and old habits and relearn our connection to nature, our connection to where our food comes from and our water comes from. But you know, it takes some effort, but it can be really an amazing journey too.
The first chapter is about turning deserts into farmland. Where is this a good idea?
Right. We're excited about the possibility of doing this in all sorts of areas where there's been both intensive desertification, parts of the world that are really arid, that the changes in land use have really damaged the land, but really all around our communities, there's places where there's a stream that just is neglected, or there's been garbage thrown into a gully, or loss of soil has resulted in a damaged piece of land. So there's places where we can do this all over, and it's pretty exciting. Even areas in cities where there's been asphalt put over the land, and in some cases too much land is covered, and aren't even using it for roads or parking. It's kind of going into disrepair. We can take up that asphalt and uncover it, build that soil up and create either spaces to be in or spaces to grow food in.
Well, there's a whole chapter about that later on, about creating more livable cities. If you got to be boss, how different would cities look?
Yes, I think they'd be really different, but it's pretty exciting that there's already a lot of changes underway of growing food on rooftops and rooftop greenhouses and putting more trees in along roads and creating parks and more spaces in cities for people to have connection to outdoors. A lot around stormwater, dealing with the water that's flowing through cities to deal with the stormwater, treat it, clean it before it goes back into a river or the ocean. So it's pretty some pretty exciting changes, but we have a lot more to do. And cities have both a real opportunity because people are living so close together. The energy use per person is actually pretty low, and yet there's a lot of damage that cities do as well. So a lot of need to change them, for sure.
You admit that the term urban ecosystem sounds strange. What does it mean?
Yeah, it's really thinking about urban areas as like an ecosystem, that they have all sorts of niches, all sorts of opportunities for ecology to be happening. There's actually a lot of wildlife, a lot of birds, a lot of pollinators, but also the way that we live in a city and the way we get our food, where do our waters come from. There's all those same interconnections that we think about when we think about the wider ecosystem. And so really tending to those different connections and looking for opportunities to make them more resilient, cleaner. Can we be collecting water? Can we be growing food in the city, as I mentioned, on a rooftop or in a small community garden or park space? And so you're really kind of thinking about those parts as a whole, as an interconnected whole, and then getting more conscious about them and sort of building them. And a lot of urban systems a lot of the thinking is now we need more resilience. We need to be able to deal with storms and problems that come up. And so that kind of thinking about urban ecosystems is a way to increase resilience.
John O'Niger, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's a conservation biologist and a permaculture expert. His book is The Permaculture Promise. You can see what that promise entails and share stories of your own. We'd love to hear if you've installed something that gives back to the planet while you're able to take some things from it. 800-838-3760 to join the conversation by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Down to specific practices, Chapter 2 is about creating self-fertile soil. I like the term you use here, the bag of fertility, going out to buy a bag of fertility. So instead of doing that, though, what do you recommend?
Right. There's a lot of different ways that we can build soil and improve fertility in an area, bring it back to what it used to be. And one way is just to use plants, the way that plants go down into the soil. They bring up nutrients that are either leaching away or from down in the subsoil. And we can cut those plants back and bring that material and compost it, or use it as a mulch layer over the soil. We can grow nitrogen fixing plants, so they're bringing nitrogen from the air that wasn't available. There's just a lot of importance to keep the soil covered, keep it either mulched or in a cover crop or in a crop, and by doing that, we're actually just mimicking the cycling of nutrients that's happening in a forest or in a grassland, and we're creating that fertility, but in a much faster way. The practice of coppicing, where we cut off the branches of a woody plant and can use that for mulching, creating brush piles and woody mulch, and then those woody plants just re-sprout, so they're just going to grow from the same root system year after year. But this is a very traditional practice that goes back millennia in parts of Europe and other parts of the world. And so these are the kind of systems where we're just basically drawing up nutrients, holding them on site, and cycling them around so that there's a lot of reuse and reconnecting these cycles.
And don't let nutrients escape, I think, which is the major point in keeping the soil covered. We talked to somebody about dry land farming a few months ago, just making sure that you keep the stuff that's there in there.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's right. And looking for opportunities to bring in some fertility from close by. So sometimes we'll plant areas in a slope, an adjacent slope, or somewhere nearby, and we're going to plant a bunch of cover crop or some of these dynamic accumulator plants. We'll harvest from there once or twice a year. We can bring those nutrients from just a few feet away into whatever garden area or growing space that we're using.
There's a whole section here about turning waste into food, which is a surprisingly broad category. Which kinds of waste?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. Well, we talked about garden waste and coppicing and woody material. That's really important to keep cycling. But also there's even human waste.
Humanure, you call it in the book.
Yeah, humanure, human waste, which right now is a pollutant and causes a lot of problems in our environment, polluting groundwater, takes a lot of energy to process. But it actually, there's some very simple technologies for composting human waste, humanure, and then using it on site, putting it down into the ground. We want to make sure that it's done intelligently and correctly. But there's a lot of potential to stop the problems associated with it and turn it into an opportunity.
There must be some limits to how you can use humanure, though.
There are. There's regulations and some important considerations to make sure that there's no pathogen contamination, and it needs to be composted correctly over a longer period of time. And so it's important to do it safely, but it's actually not something that is that difficult, and it's something that we can do and has been done for some time. I have a compost toilet that's actually in the basement of my house, and it's a large bin. We empty it every 2 years, and then we'll do some composting of that material outside in a safe bin, and then it's available to be cycled back out onto the land, and all those nutrients can be reused.
Wow. And in fact, you have a story from here in the Pacific Northwest about working in an orchard using wood waste to enrich the soil. Tell us about that.
Mm-hmm. That's right. There's a whole series of different techniques for using woody material, trees, branches, wood chips, all sorts of things that can be cycled back into the soil. One of them is called Hügel culture. It's a German word for mound culture, where basically you're stacking up that woody material, adding some soil, and the wood is going to slowly break down, give its fertility back to the soil. But in the meantime, it's also holding a lot of moisture. It's providing habitat for critters in the soil. So it's really, instead of seeing that material as a waste product, something that we need to get rid of and is a problem, then we're just cycling it onto the ground and using it to build soil, build garden beds, build terraces. So if you have a sloped area, you can use that woody material to hold back the slope, create flatter areas to be able to walk around, and at the same time, it's building the soil.
We're talking permaculture with Jono Niger here on the Jefferson Exchange, and you're welcome to join us. Jono is a conservation biologist and a permaculture expert. His book is called The Permaculture Promise. It's got lavish illustrations. It's subtitled What Permaculture Is and How It Can Help Us. The general idea, giving back to the land while you're taking things from it in a constantly symbiotic sort of system. Join us on the exchange with your questions, your comments, your stories, perhaps. Maybe you've done some permaculture installations or have some concepts you'd like to see explored. We'd like to hear them. 800-838-3760 and jx@jeffnet.org. And the concepts go beyond, obviously, working the earth and working the soil here, but things like building community. And there's a real sense in this part of the book that we are interdependent, and there's this whole there's a great example in history of Henry David Thoreau at Walden Pond and the fact that he really wasn't quite as isolated as he said. What's the story there?
Right. That's right. It's really interesting because we have kind of a mythology that Thoreau was out in the woods, and he was doing everything on his own, and it kind of fits in with our rugged individualist iconic idea of how people need to be, and the back to the land movement of the 60s and 70s kind of fit with that, where people went back and made their own homestead, and really I think we're kind of coming around full circle again and realizing that that's one way to do it. But also, a lot of us live in communities, we live in cities, we live in neighborhoods, and we're not going to do everything ourselves, but we need our neighbors. We need the people around us who can do one part, and everybody has their part, their skill, what they're passionate about, and that all can come together and create very strong, interconnected, integrated communities. And so it's the power of a group to do all the things that we need to do versus each of us individually.
All right, let's take a call here. We have Rebecca in Junction City on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with John O'Niger. We're talking permaculture.
Hi. I live in the hills with a sloping property that has seeps running from the mountain down through the property. And so I thought I'd take advantage of that last year, and I did one hoogle just to test it. And it really worked well, and I planted spinach and a couple other things down there, and I didn't have to water them for like 3 months into the year where I would normally be watering.
It's a hoogle, you say?
Yes, yeah.
What is that?
The mound.
The hoogle culture, using those woody debris. Did you use some pretty good-sized logs doing that?
Yeah, I did. I used varying sizes of oak logs that I have fallen branches on my property.
All right. Thanks.
Thanks for
sharing the story, Rebecca. So this is an example of a way that you can just use what's around you and take advantage of what's around you.
Right. And to understand that kind of material, that those big logs are going to take years, maybe decades to break down. And in the process of doing that, they're really enriching the soil and they're creating a sponge underground.
Other things that you'll talk about here, just in terms of land-based systems, like making wetlands and river edges productive. I mean, you don't mean put factories on them. What do you mean?
No, I mean it's a technique, and again, some very, very old techniques that go back just millennia in different societies that were living along streams, along wetland edges or coastal edges, and the ability to use those zones as food production, to grow fiber for building things, for fabrics and rope and twine, and so those edge zones are really amazingly rich in their opportunities, and so instead of seeing it as a place that we're just going to come in and do what we want and change it completely, there's opportunities for utilizing those zones, those edge places to get our needs met for food and fiber and medicinal plants, et cetera. But also leaving space for all the other creatures, the other important parts of the ecosystem and the important functions that those places play. Like wetlands are, we know, now they're vitally important for the ecosystem, for cleansing water, for recharging aquifers.
Yeah, and Arcata Marsh, in fact,
habitat.
Yeah, Arcata Marsh in our region is certainly provided in this part of the book, where it gets a couple of pages. Let's take a final call here before we have to go. Jan and Eugene, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with John O'Niger.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
Great topic. I'd like to see the conversation return a little bit more to where it was a moment ago, talking about social permaculture, about how neighbors, how communities mm-hmm. can use permaculture principles to do that kind of community building, social capital, mm-hmm. Doing projects in a permaculture collaborative way that are a scale larger than what somebody can do on their own, because, of course, what the situation, the global situation calls for is way more than somebody's 5-acre property or their suburban backyard.
Okay, let's get an
answer. The situation calls for a whole lot more than that. So
I'd like
to hear some more comments about that.
Thank you. So, John, all your thoughts?
Yeah, great. Well, thank you for bringing us back around to that, because there is really a huge need and some really exciting things that communities, people, neighborhoods can do as they come together and start to think about reskilling, learning the skills from seed saving to growing vegetables or food preservation and animal husbandry and those kinds of skill sharing, to even sharing, putting in renewable energy systems and helping out for some of the technological aspects of that. And there's people coming together to do tool shares, reading clubs, hosting a permaculture blitz where people will go around between a neighborhood and put in gardens and change a yard area around a home. So a lot of exciting possibilities at the community scale.
Absolutely. We learn a lot from the book. It's called The Permaculture Promise. It's about how we can use permaculture to do things like including reverse climate change. Jono Niger is a conservation biologist and a permaculture designer and educator, wrote the book and joined us today in the exchange. Jono, thank you.
Thank you very much, Jeffrey.